WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The holidays are a time of celebration. They also can be a time for reflection, a time to think about how religion does or doesn't figure into our lives. My guest is Father Michael Doyle, a deeply religious man who, during his 28 years in the priesthood, has had his differences with the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. We're going to talk about some of the spiritual and social issues he has wrestled with over the years, and about a deeper meaning of Christmas, which he is still able to discern through all the parties and shopping that surround the holiday. Father Doyle is the pastor of the Sacred Heart Church in Camden, New Jersey. It's a neighborhood Doyle once described as an urban scrap heap of gutted factories, boarded homes, and broken dreams. He has turned his church into a place not only for spiritual guidance and charity, but also for social change. His sermons are so moving and inspiring that people from affluent suburbs have been known to drive in on Sundays to hear him. Doyle grew up in Northern Ireland and has lived in America since 1959, when he turned 25. Welcome to Fresh Air and Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
You know, it's very nice that Christmas and Hanukkah, the Festival of the Lights, coincide with the winter solstice and with the darkest part of the year.
I think that's a delightful realization that at the time of least light in this part of the world, when the night is longest, that we celebrate light. It connects with a very deep part of us to hold out against death and our own darkness, and to be able to within the darkness to kind of light our candle and declare, come what may, that the light will break through. And it connects us also with people of very ancient times, going back like to Neolithic times, and like particularly in Ireland, where they've found such wonderful passage graves, and they found one in Newgrange in Ireland, and it's just utterly magnificent, and it's like a small hill and an opening in the side of it facing east, and you could walk into the center about 50 feet into the center. And in the center, on the ground, there's a stone basin in which they put the ashes of the dead. But back, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, they discovered, when they excavated and restored this wonderful monument that goes back to Neolithic man, they discovered that, well, they were kind of trying to figure out, well, does it have any connection with the sun? And they were trying to connect it with Stonehenge and things like that. But so there was nothing in the summer that made any sense. So they went to the winter, and they went in there in this the winter solstice in December 21, 22, those days. And on the 21st of December, I think maybe it might have been 67, they found that at 10 minutes after 9, the sun rose and just peeked over the hill that's about a mile away. And the first rays of it went through a hole above the door, and the passageway is uphill inside, and that ray is a pencil ray, went right through into the end of the grave and lit up the basin of the ashes of the dead on the day of least light. So you connect there with those people who somehow, and of course I'm from Ireland, Southern Ireland, of course, but. But anyway,
okay.
We have long nights, and of course, very little with no electricity and so forth. So you kind of, in the midst of this incredible darkness, the welcoming of the sun was such a big thing because it meant survival. So I find that to have Christmas, the birth of the Son of God, or the sort of bright spot in the darkness, connected with the just that basic universal cosmic reality is delightful, and that the Jewish people would have their Hanukkah and their Feast of Light and right there, and that the Christians would thank God. I think that we have no birth certificate for Jesus. you could be stuck with July, you know. So we have right. We put them right in the right spot at right there, so that we can celebrate something bigger, which is the universal, I think, breakthrough of light. You know?
As you mentioned, you were born in Ireland, and I'm interested in why you came to America after you became a priest. How come you didn't want to stay in Ireland?
Well, the problem was that they had at that time that there were too many of these clerics floating around, so they had to export me. And the school I went to did not provide for the Irish clergy, you know, and so we were up for export, and it kind of happens that sons of poorer people, poor farmers and propertyless people, end up on the foreign missions of as we call them of the world, and so I had to find myself somewhere outside of Ireland, and I had options like Australia and New Zealand and South Africa and different places to pick and choose from. So I thought I'd pick United States, and I picked Camden because I thought, well, you could reach New York by car. It was that profound.
Were you surprised by what Camden turned out to be like?
Oh, I was, of course, in no way at all. I was surprised. In fact, my notion of the United States was that everybody was rich, and I just saw returned Irish people in their best finery, you know, in Ireland, and they looked very rich. They had gold watches and all sorts of things that were enormous in the 40s, where we were so poor following the war. And when I came, I remember distinctly in New York City in the first days I was here, going into a department store, the likes of which I had never seen before. And my cousin said, oh, she said, that jacket would fit, there was a sale on, that jacket would fit Danny, her husband, that jacket would fit Danny, but he doesn't get paid till Thursday. Well, I was shocked, you know, that any American could say such a thing, that she didn't have enough money to buy the jacket. So my perception was, this is a land of, where the streets are paved in gold, you know. So I end up in Camden, which, of course, everyone has ever seen it, and I've had people who had visited Beirut, Belfast, the works, you know, but they say they'd never seen a place quite like Camden.
Did you feel that it was part of your calling at that time to minister to the poor and to work in a very poverty-stricken neighborhood?
I really didn't. I didn't have any notion what I would. I was just surprised it existed. No, I didn't. I just kind of couldn't quite fathom it, and but I began to connect a little bit with the gospel and with justice. As I went along, I was a teacher for a while, for 6 years. I taught religion in high schools, and so I had to begin to think about this stuff a little more. So I began to see that the gospel had to be good news, and if it's going to be good news, it's got to be good news for poor people, particularly, you know. So then I got very interested in that.
One of the things that happened to you in the 60s was that you started to part ways with the church hierarchy and with the United States government. You started speaking out against the war in Vietnam. You opposed a church band performing in a war parade. You ended up being with a group of people who destroyed draft board records. Now, I think that priests are expected to have a certain amount of obedience to the hierarchy, and it's sometimes perceived as just suppressing your ego in a way, too, that obedience. Did you have a crisis of conscience before deciding if you were going to speak out and oppose the government or oppose the church, and if so, how you were going to do it?
I don't know what you would call it. I was a very obedient and dutiful seminarian. That's a person in the seminary. It's not a very common word, but I was. I didn't break many rules at all. I don't think I did. Amazingly, when I think back on it, you know, I was so dutiful. But then I guess as I got older, I began to see that my own know, human development or my own place, or I somehow had to break out a little bit out of the mold that I was in, the expected one, which is very polite and very fitted, very
accommodating
and nice. And I could see it could very easily be that a clergy person could be very easily used by the society to add a little bit of a glow to their agenda. And so Father said, or Reverend says so, or say a few words, Reverend, or bless this, pray that. You could be trotted out for a political convention or whatever. They'd trot you out and say the few words and put you back in the box, you know. You're like a candle on the table. Nice, but nobody's eating the candle. So after a bit, you get this, hey, to be human or to connect or to find your own identity or your own sense of existence, or who are you, or what do you mean, or that something had to come from the ground up. I began to realize that the theology I had learned was very much from the sky down or something. Everything was from above coming down. But I was raised on a farm, and I was raised where we had the birth of calves and little pigs, and we had chickens, and we had earth, and we lived right off the earth. Everything came from below. So I began to redo theology in my own, try not to redo it, but re-understand it, that maybe God became a man. That's the Christian perspective, that you know, it's God, the people of Israel said God walks with them. God is, you know, in Fiddler on the Roof, he talks to the God and the cows in the same breath. I said, wait a minute, there's truth here at the bottom. There's truth here right on the ground, and that's where we start. And the wise men had to get off their camels to see the baby in the manger, and it was right out of the ground it came. And I said, ah. So I began to sort of say, I could stand on my own spot on this earth, and I could dig into what I know, and what I know from mangers and fields and cabbage patches is as solid as what anybody else knows. From that came this sort of determination that we got to connect the gospel, the theology, with the reality. And in fact, the reality will speak the gospel if we look at it. Like, we'll see the stars at night, or we'll see beauty in Camden, or we'll see, you know, you get a whole different notion. And that some little person struggling in the project may be the much more clearly the voice of God than somebody who is dressed up and set up to make pronouncements.
Do you ever feel that you were punished for ever challenging the hierarchy?
Well, I don't know. When I was taken out of teaching, I felt it was a punishment then. Because I opposed the war and I said so and things like that. So I was taken out of teaching, not at my own wishes, and put into Camden. So I felt at that time that I wanted to stay in teaching longer. So I felt that was a sort of a punishment, you know. But punishments are blessings, you know.
So it was a blessing when you got to be the priest at Sacred Heart Church.
Absolutely. I mean, sure, there was I didn't come directly to Sacred Heart. I've been in Camden now, this coming year will be my 20th year, and I was in St. Joseph's and other parishes. But it was a great blessing because I began, even though I was totally unurban and totally, I just never lived in a city and would hate the thought I could ever be left in a city, yet I found that in this urban poor situation, I began to an extent swimming in my own stream, you know. But not that I would still go back to my sources or my strengths, or what you said, well, what keeps him alive, or what is it? Well, it's the beauty that I would find in people, which I've learned to find from my own childhood among ordinary little people.
I want to talk with you more about your life and religion, Christmas, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Father Michael Doyle, who's the pastor at the Sacred Heart Church in Camden, New Jersey. This is Fresh Air. Father Michael Doyle is my guest. You know what I'm wondering? When, in the years that you've been the pastor at Sacred Heart Church, especially when you first got there, did people have preconceptions of what a church was supposed to be in the community, what function it was supposed to serve, and how you were supposed to behave as the pastor of that church? Preconceptions that you wanted to change because they didn't fit your idea of what your role should be in the community and what your church should be in the community?
Well, a lot had been done before I came. See, Camden had changed immensely in the previous, in previous 10, 15 years, the population had changed. People had become they were poorer now, and there were less Catholics, for example. People who had been there before me had tried to reach out to the new coming Black community in the neighborhood and so forth, and I suppose it was a development. It wasn't something that I kind of came in and sort of had a whole new brand of ideas. I did try to when I came. I thought, well, we try to develop liturgy more thoroughly and to make it a people's liturgy, you know. And I had a lot of people to help me to do that, and that a church would be a kitchen rather than a restaurant, so that when people came to church, they didn't come in and say, wait for the waiter to provide, but rather, this is my spot, and I wash dishes here, and I know where things are. And it's that perception that belongs to the people, and if it comes out of the people, and if it's their worship, and they own it, then out of that will rise some beautiful things, and that has been true. So that changed. Then the next step was to be able to see that liturgy, the worship of the people, would lead to justice. That if you break bread on Sunday, break it on Monday. So that you must make those connections. You can't, that the celebration of the Eucharist, which we have, and the breaking of bread for in ultimate communion and friendship and hope, that has to be translated into breaking up the things that divide people, or to share. And we carry baskets of food to the altar every Sunday so that people can physically and dramatically express their sharing with the poor. And that what we're celebrating is the ultimate dream, that one day people will have enough. And but sometimes a worship can be so much of a blessing on the status quo rather than a challenge, that first to be challenged and then to be enabled to be people of justice, and to be concerned about people's rights and concerned about housing, and all that is connected.
You know, I want to mention to our listeners that you're not wearing a priest's garments, you're not wearing a collar, you're wearing a sweater and a button-down shirt. Now, I'm sure, or I'd guess, that for Christmas services that you wear vestments. And I'm interested in where you think it's a wonderful thing to have the garments of ritual, and where you think it's really unnecessary and where it's more appropriate to just wear a cardigan. Do you know what I mean? Because I think you have a distinct sense of where that kind of ritual and ceremony fits in and where it's really off-putting and unnecessary.
Yeah, I have a kind of a resentment to uniforms of any kind on anyone. I think that we should sort of fade into the picture rather than to be strikingly different in the picture. I often think if I was a bird, I'd be female. You wouldn't see me in the long grass. I would fade into it. So I think that we should be of the people, with the people, the same as the people. But then at times where we reach the area of ritual, then someone dressed then becomes a useful tool and a useful focus. So then you use it there, and it's far more distinctive than if you come out of the mud or the rubble or the work or the whatever job you're doing, and you're washed and cleaned and dressed, and then that. So you try to elevate things and try to connect with ritual. Ritual is very, very important for the human being to enter into it that somehow to be able to celebrate that the bit I do is a pebble in a cosmic pond. It's very big. It has an impact, and the power of the collective mind in prayer would generate and would push things forward. That you just can't, if you're really sensitive and conscious, and you focus on the immensity of what needs to be done, and you look at what you're able to do, the immensity of what's not done will cripple what you're able to do. But if you bring it into the area of ritual and with this kind of ancient form of gathering people into a collective lifting of reality and lifting of situations, then you connect with everything that's going on. So you're not just trapped in the failure of your little bit, but you're connected. And that's what's so very, very important, that people don't, otherwise they have two choices then, one choice they make, they'll be very independent, isolated and indifferent. Or they'll burn out. People get into social activism. They won't last too long. There are not many long-lasting social activists. They burn because the failure, the sense of failure is too much.
Well, let me ask this question about yourself, because you are a social activist and a religious activist. And whereas other people have their priest to turn to or a psychotherapist or something, who do you have to turn to? And what prevents you from burning out? You have done a remarkable amount in the years that you've been a priest, both politically, in the area of community work, charity, and of course, spirituality. So how do you keep from burning out? Or don't you worry about it because you feel it's your calling and as opposed to a job?
Well,
maybe it's different for you.
See, I think that the Sunday puts me back together. The week will break me up.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sunday gathering of the people in the ritual, which is a very... And that's true of rituals in all religions, if they're done well, they will actually restore people. So I find that when the people come around me on Sunday and when we go through the ritual, I will be put back together again. That is that combination of the elevation of reality, the gathering in of things, the connecting of our little effort in Camden with what's happening in South Africa or what's happening in the north of Ireland, or what's happening in Nicaragua, or what's happening in the Bronx. The pulling of things together, and you feel that you're part of one great cosmic development, and then that's nourishing, and that's I find that to be my sustenance and my salvation.
What will you be talking about at Christmas Mass?
Well... It's not sometimes wise to ask me what I'll be talking about because I could change very quickly. I do like approaching Christmas as... what I like to say about it is that the church should pick it up when the merchants drop it. By tonight at midnight, the life will be squeezed out of it. So at this point, we should pick it up and make it into a good, healthy, seasonal uplift for the people and celebrate it, you know. And so I think that, and don't make it a bottleneck. Don't make Christmas a little thing. As somebody once said to me on the 26th of December, how was your Christmas? I said, was? It just hasn't begun yet. It is a season that gets me through the winter where we celebrate light and its presence and friendship and coming together. So I like to talk about that. And I like to talk about the idea that the birth of Christ must be seen so deeply as the birth and the rebirth of your own dream, the dream that's down deep in your own heart. And I have this kind of feeling that if you were to get from people across the world, from Michigan to Moscow, from South Africa to wherever, Alaska, you. And ask each individual, what would you do if you had the power to do it? If you had unlimited power to transform and change, what would you do? And I believe that people would all say that they wanted human beings to reach their full development. And they wanted peace in the world, and they wanted creativity and good place for children to grow up, and they'd want no war and weapons put away, and they would. The dream that's in the human heart, I think, is universal. And I think that the celebration of Christmas is a celebration of Christ, who incorporates that for us, that dream of lifting all things to its fulfillment, to their fulfillment. So I want people to say, celebrate the dream that's inside of you. Celebrate that best desire at the bottom of your being, that all will be well. Celebrate that. Don't let any, before they step on it, and have one shining moment where that comes to life again before, you know, the brutality of existence and the pressure, and you're stuck in traffic and you don't have money, or there's all sorts of demands on you, before it squeezes the life out of it again. But celebrate that. So I'm very interested in that idea. And I think that the celebrating of that deep down hope, and that's there, it's universal, that gets its moment in the sun, that collectively, that urges everything forward. And I would like to, I often think, to ask Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to sit down, not at a table someday, but sit down at a cradle and measure their nooks as they look at a child, and talk about the waste of the resources of this Mother Earth on weapons, and say, the child will tell us. And Christmas is a time when you get the kings off their camels, and you get the big shots off their high places, and you say, bend down and look and measure reality by the worth of a baby. And if politics was run on that, it'd be a different world.
I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us and for speaking with us today. Thank you for being here. My guest has been Father Michael Doyle, and he's the pastor of the Sacred Heart Church in Camden, New Jersey. And I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, and thank you for sharing some of it with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My name is Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.